Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and that awful Philadelphia shootout this week where a lone gunman was able to hold off police for 8 straight hours and hold 2 police officers hostage after shooting and injuring 6 reminds us that police officers are on the front lines of combating America's daily gun violence. It's now being reported that the Philly gunman likely had an AR-15 assault-style weapon, and just a day later, 4 men and a teenager were shot in a separate shooting on that same street. During a press briefing Wednesday night, as the incident was still going on with the police, 2 Philly officers called on lawmakers to help get guns off the streets. They were backed up by their mayor, Jimmy Kenney. Here's 20 seconds of what he said.
But our officers need help. They need help. They need help with gun control. They need help with keeping these weapons out of these people's hands. I mean, I told you earlier, the 2 little boys that were, the officer had his head grazed just a little bit more, and those 2 little boys will grow up without their dad. Because this government, both on the federal and state level, don't want to do anything about getting these guns off the streets and getting them out of the hands of criminals.
One might expect the police to be united on the gun debate, seeing as they are constantly at risk and that police safety as an issue would play a big role in resolving the national issue of whether they should be outgunned by the bad guys, should they have AK-47s and things like that ever legally in anybody's possession other than the police. But as my next guest will explain, the issue of guns divides police officers like it does the rest of America. Jennifer Dawson Carlson is a sociologist at the University of Arizona and author of the book Citizen Protectors on the Politics of Gun Carry Laws, and of the forthcoming book Policing the Second Amendment on Public Law Enforcement and Gun Politics. Professor Carlson, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Were you surprised to hear that clip from Philly?
I wasn't surprised that the mayor was representing officers on behalf of a call for gun control, no. I think that there's a lot, once you get into sort of the terrain of law enforcement, which, by the way, there's 10,000 or over 10,000 law enforcement agencies, you know, multiply that by the number of officers in each agency, we're talking about a lot of people that, as you already said, you know, law enforcement is divided much like, you know, the broader public is divided. But there are some actually pretty striking differences between the broader public's pulse on gun control and gun regulation versus law enforcement. So, for example, Pew a few years ago actually released one of the first national studies that gave us some insight into police attitudes on a whole range of issues, from marijuana legalization to gun control to police subculture. So, it fascinating survey. But what they revealed in that survey was, if you look at police attitudes on guns, if you just ask them straight out, you know, do you support gun control versus gun rights, which is a question that is very typically answered in Pew poll or asked in Pew polls on gun politics, police actually far outnumbered civilians in terms of their, or private civilians in terms of their support for gun rights over gun control. They also were much more likely than private civilians to oppose an assault weapons ban, which actually probably surprises a lot of people. Other data suggests that police are much more, very much in favor of licensed concealed carry. And so this is actually where my research jumps off. I interviewed police chiefs in California, Arizona, and Michigan to try and make sense of what was going on with public law enforcement's attitude on gun policies.
Let's pick each of those apart. Why would people in law enforcement oppose an assault weapons ban?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question that definitely surprised me when I was going into the research. So there are, so how do I unpack this? So the first thing to say is that police, we tend to think about the gun debate as a national debate, right? That we're going to ban AR-15s at the national level, or we're going to have national reciprocity or what have you. Police are actually operating in local and state regulatory environments. So to some extent, that shapes how they think about assault weapons, for example. One thing that I found absolutely fascinating in the California context, so I actually included California because I expected here's a state where I'm going to get a lot of support. Support among police chiefs for stricter gun laws. They were definitely more supportive than my Arizona and Michigan chiefs. But what I found was that they actually kind of found themselves that the law had actually created this kind of catch-22 for many officers, where they could legally so even though assault weapons are banned in California, police have an exemption until they retire. But many times, police agencies themselves do not actually fund the purchase of the AR, you know, a police officer's AR-15. So they buy the AR-15, and then they retire, and they're told you have to give this back. Well, what does that do over? What is the impression that that's going to give a law enforcement officer in terms of gun laws, for example? So there's really interesting sort of intricacies in terms of the gun law. But the broader question, I think, really comes down to how police understand gun violence. We tend to also talk about gun violence as this kind of broad category, catch-all category. What I found in my conversations with police chiefs is that urban gun violence, active shootings, domestic gun violence, all of these things not only were very distinct in the minds of police officers or police chiefs, but they also called for very different kinds of gun laws. Found very much resonant with sort of the broader NRA line that criminals don't obey gun laws. When police chiefs were talking about urban gun crime and all that sort of is associated with, that was very much we need to have tough criminal sanctions. That yes, we need to vet people, but banning guns is not going to solve the problem. And I have lots of very very blunt quotes about that from police chiefs. And so that's where sort of that comes in, is that it's actually police are not thinking of it simply in terms of a ban guns or not ban guns kind of thing. There's actually a lot more tools at their disposal, and a lot of this is wrapped up in sort of a broader war on crime kind of mentality.
Listeners, we want to open up the phones primarily right now for anybody who works in law enforcement, police officers, retired police officers, anyone else in law enforcement who might want to weigh in on this conversation. As a current or former law enforcement official, your view on the gun laws? What needs to be done with your experience on the street or wherever you worked to reduce gun violence in America? And how much or how little, in your opinion, does it have to do with gun laws, such as banning assault weapons or background checks, or what we'll get into next with Professor Carlson, licensing, which he said many people in law enforcement do support. So police officers, retired police officers, anyone else, what's your opinion on this? How does your experience inform the gun laws debate in your opinion? 212-433-WNYC. We invite you in at 212-433-9692 with Jennifer Dawson Carlson, sociologist at the University of Arizona, and author of the book Citizen Protectors and the forthcoming book Policing the Second Amendment. Talk about licensing, which you brought up before. A lot of people, I think, believe that that's sort of the thing that gun rights advocates most want to hold off. They might rather see an assault weapons ban and more universal background checks than having to register every gun. So talk about police opinions on licensing and what that would actually entail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that licensing in terms of, I think when you're saying licensing, you mean like registration, like a mandatory federal registration, which was, banned in the 1980s under the Firearm Owners Protection Act. So that actually did not come up a lot in my conversations with public law enforcement, simply because it was it's so far removed from the political terrain right now in terms of what's being debated. I think generally police are in favor. So one thing to kind of think through as we're breaking this down is this idea that we don't have gun control in the U.S., right? So we do have gun laws and gun regulations, and they tend to take the form of tough-on-crime gun laws, right? Mandatory minimums, added sentencing enhancements with regard to offenses committed either with a gun or in the presence of a firearm. So we have that set of things. Then we have sort of the regulation of the gun itself. So gun bans, regulations on magazine capacities and what have you. And then we have licensing and vetting of lawful gun owners. And so those are all, you know, very distinct things that kind of, when you ask, are you pro-gun or pro-gun control or pro-gun rights, you kind of have to break down all of those things. So I would say in terms of the licensing and the registration piece of it, law enforcement want vetting. They want tracking. They want universal background checks. They want mental health checks, all of that. Now, that being said, law enforcement, especially with regard to red flag laws, are pretty cognizant of the constitutional issues kind of embedded in different kinds of vetting. But that's where that kind of breaks down. So in terms of licensed concealed carry, public law enforcement, I found in my interviews with chiefs at least, support the idea of quote unquote the good guys, so the licensed vetted people having firearms. And I think a lot of that is wrapped up with active shootings and the emergence of active shootings as a new policing problem in the post-Columbine era. They're in favor of that. They are, you know, overall sort of aligned politically with gun rights. And I can actually get into that in terms of the NRA and public law enforcement. That's a fascinating relationship over the last century. But they're at the same time very much in favor of increasing law enforcement tools. And so that's the language that's often used, is that it's not about a gun ban or gun, you know, heavy gun restrictions. It's about, you know, allowing public law enforcement the tools to deal with the problem of gun rather than eradicating guns. And that's a really different way and a very law enforcement way of thinking about this problem.
You mentioned the police community's relationship with the NRA. What is the police mm-hmm. community's relationship with the NRA?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So if you actually go on the NRA's website, they have a list of organizations that they categorically disagree with, organizations that promote gun control, and you will see some police organizations on there. But by and large, the NRA has actually made a concerted effort, and this is actually since the early 1900s. In 1916, one of the NRA magazines actually published a piece that called for police to be trained and qualified in firearms. So this idea that police should qualify with their firearms, which is something we just take for granted today, is actually something that the NRA really pushed in the early 20th century. So this was before, obviously, there were the FBI trained police officers in firearms. This is before, this is just as police are seeing firearms as a standard part of the police uniform, which is something that we take for granted. And so after that, the relationship between the NRA and police kind of, for the most part, is between hot and warm. Generally, it's not cold, although during the 1980s, of course, is the era where, we have debates over cop killer bullets. And that's where a lot of law enforcement actually break from the NRA. And it's actually interesting if you read media coverage from that period, there's a lot of surprise among, journalists that, oh, the NRA and that law enforcement are, you know, this is a relationship that always has been so strong. It's falling apart, under the weight of gun control. And of course, gun control is the one, liberal issue that conservative tough on crime cops are willing to, willing to align with in the 1980s. What I find really fascinating about this period, so this is also the period where you have LAPD police chief Daryl Gates, who actually is on the front lines of pushing for an assault weapons ban, first in California and then at the federal level. And what, it's easy to look back on that and say, okay, so to read the terms of our contemporary gun politics into that era. But that was really part and parcel of sort of this emergent or I should say unfolding police militarization and police war on crime that was happening at the time. And so he was arguing for, you know, not just let's ban these guns, but let's also make sure police have these guns in their arsenals. This is, you know, this is a war and our, you know, frontline officers are dying in this war. And I think that's really, that's a really important thing to kind of, you know, unpack, that this was not simply gun control as sort of many gun control proponents think about it today. It was really part and parcel of this tough on crime politics. Into the 1990s, I think the NRA gets much more focused on building relationships with the public law enforcement. The Fraternal Order of Police, actually, in the 1980s, came out in favor of gun control. Shifts in that organization has brought it closer to the NRA. And so, you know, you can go on the NRA website and read NRA materials. There's actually a magazine and a whole lot of media that the NRA produces just for public law enforcement and other public servants. There are line of duty death benefits. There are awards, obviously still training. A lot of what the NRA does is actually offer training in police competitions. So this is actually a relationship that has been forged over the past century. And so it's not actually entirely surprising once you unpack this history. The NRA has actually worked quite hard to cultivate ties with public law enforcement.
Ron and Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Wow. Thanks for accepting my call. I'm a retired probation officer, also a firearms instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel that I'm as true blue as you can get, too. But people have to realize that guns in this country are not going away. They're going to be here. So it's our duty to make sure that they're regulated in some way, whether that's licensing or whatever. They must be regulated. And as for the AR-15, see, again, I think that's location. An AR-15 in Manhattan, no. An AR-15 in Alaska, yes. In Wyoming, yes. Those are places where people use them constantly.
How about Dayton?
How about what?
Dayton.
Dayton, Ohio?
Yeah.
Definitely not. No
cities.
No AR-15s in Dayton, Ohio. But that's all I wanted to say, and that people are going to realize you can't get rid of the guns in the United States. They're here to stay.
Yeah, and I think just to back that up, I mean, that very much resonates with what my conversations with police chiefs were like. And I think there is, going back to that anecdote I gave about the AR-15, the assault weapons ban in California, and how contemporary police officers think about that, I think there is, you know, it's very blatant to see how police come into contact on the front lines of gun law enforcement when you think of a terrible tragedy like what happened in Philadelphia. But they also come into contact with gun regulations in a lot of different ways. What kind of guns they can own, can they access the kind of ammo and guns that they want to purchase. So one of the chiefs I actually interviewed in Michigan, I believe, he actually said, you know, the whole gun debate is actually making it difficult to purchase the kinds of firearms that he sees are as necessary for his agency. Chiefs in California, you know, when different bullet bans and gun bans went into effect, you can check out the specific companies actually said, okay, well, if we're not allowed to sell in California, we're not also going to sell to law enforcement. And so that put a strain on law enforcement. So there's a way in which these politics actually percolate into very different, as very different consequences than mm-hmm. you necessarily think when you're saying, okay, we're going to ban AR-15s to make the lives of police easier.
Let's take another call. Don in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. Look, I think, you know, from a local level, local policing level, a lot of us has responded to 911 calls after the fact that a crime has been committed. And when you take into account violent crime, right, I think a lot of us have seen victims who are not able to protect themselves due to certain gun laws. And I think, you know, that's one of the main things the law enforcement kind of why law enforcement supports gun rights is because we truly feel that citizens should be able to protect themselves because just cops cannot be everywhere at any time. You know, I think that your other caller has a good point in terms of like certain types of firearms are more appropriate in certain types of in certain places in America. Uh-huh. But I think, you know, overall, the gun debate is like is very overreaching in terms of we should let all the guns in and then we should, we should ban all the other guns. But I think from a law enforcement perspective, I do feel that, you know, a lot of cops believe in people's rights to defend themselves just because we've seen what happens when they can't.
That's interesting. I think the gun control camp would argue that that sounds good in theory, but what really happens is the more guns that are out there, the more incidents of guns being used criminally or for suicides.
Was that a question?
Yeah, that's a question for you. I mean, it's. I'm just posing the other side's argument to you that the attitude that you're describing, that it helps police officers if law-abiding citizens are armed, if I understood you correctly, that the other camp would say, that sounds good in theory, but what really happens is if everybody has a gun, you're going to wind up, just by the laws of percentages, with more gun crimes, more gun suicides. Do you think that's not true?
Well, I think like the stats seem to prove that. I think that's kind of non-debatable when you look at stats in America and stats in other parts of the country. Other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I don't think law enforcement necessarily doesn't believe in actually vetting people and actually doing background checks. I think the culture and the quote unquote fear of gun control is the idea that once you let, you know, legislation start to affect the prohibition of certain firearms, then it's a trickling effect and it'll never end. And mm-hmm. That's kind of the culture anti-gun measures.
Yes, that slippery slope. Don, thank you so much. Call us again. Let me get another caller in. John in Rockville Center, retired captain from the NYPD, I'm told. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. How are you? I did 34 years in New York City Police Department, retired captain. I'm also a lawyer, and I teach law up at John Jay College.
Uh-huh.
I personally am, I think the proliferation of guns in the United States has gone out of control. I believe that all assault weapons should be totally banned. They're for war. They're not for carrying. As for concealed permits, you know, naturally, I'd be in favor of background checks and red flags. But I would carry it even further and restrict, like New York City does, any carry permits where you'd have to prove that it's absolutely necessary that you need the permit. I believe that the access to guns out in the public is just causing all the problems that we have in law enforcement.
Why do you think, and if you think this is an accurate statement, why do you think more people in law enforcement don't agree with what you just said?
I think it's just this fear that some people have that you're restricting their Second Amendment rights to carry a gun, which I think is just a false flag. You can see that if you compare the United States to any other country in the world, our murder rate, our homicide rate is just off the charts.
Yeah.
And this is a direct result to the proliferation of guns that we have in the United States. We have more guns than we do population in the United States. It's out of control.
John, thank you for your service, and thank you for your call. Professor Carlson, do you write about masculinity in your book, like how an officer's definition of manhood affects their position on gun rights?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think this isn't a unique thing to gun rights. I think there's a lot of scholars that have talked about the relationship between masculinity and policing. So when we think about the warrior cop, there's kind of this archetype of, you know, the tough, courageous, running to danger rather than running from danger, sort of ideal of what a police officer is. And a lot of that has to do with sort of this masculine ethos of crime fighting. And we saw this actually really clearly play out in Parkland when The sheriff's deputy did not run to danger during that active shooting, and actually, you know, took cover. And there was a lot of really, really, really heavy criticism of what he did. So most certainly, you know, masculinity is sort of part and parcel of sort of the pulse of public law enforcement, and that's not a new thing for me to say. But what I found what was really fascinating was how differently we could say gender, but also emotions were kind of intertwined with different kinds of with the idea of responding to different kinds of gun violence. So I mentioned earlier that active shootings have really changed how police think about, or at least in when I talk to gun to police chiefs, they often talked about active shootings as sort of this breaking point in really transforming how they think about not just gun violence and gun law, but also even their own guns. And so one thing that came out really striking when we think about, for example, the quote unquote urban gun violence, which, you know, obviously that has a lot of, there's racial sort of racial code words baked into that. There's this idea of sort of the urban, racialized criminal thug. And that definitely evokes this kind of hard charger policing. With regard to active shootings, which, you know, we think about the stereotype of an active shooter as, a troubled white male. Mm-hmm. And this is obviously the narrative of mental health and what have you. Police very much did not have this sort of hard charging attitude. I mean, not that they didn't want to stop the threat and whatever, what have you, but that it was very much this sort of sense of, I would be ashamed if I did not, if I was not able to respond. I would be devastated. Mm-hmm. Those lives would be lost on me. Now, a lot of that comes down to the police response to Columbine, when police secured the perimeter and waited outside for the experts who SWAT to arrive. Mm-hmm. and sweep the inside of that school. And so that's where actually a lot of this support for gun rights comes in, because it's this idea of there has to be a first responder on the scene. If it's not me, at least if there's someone else, they can help save those kids. And this is really this. So it's a very there's still kind of this fatherly protection. Mm-hmm. But it's a really different way of thinking about sort of emotions and masculinity and policing.
I want to take a call in just a second on the racial aspect that you just brought up of who the perpetrator is. But mm-hmm. First, let me give my legal ID. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we're finishing up with Jennifer Dawson Carlson from the University of Arizona, author of Citizen Protectors and a forthcoming book, Policing the Second Amendment, on law enforcement attitudes toward the gun rights versus gun control debate. And Gary in Summit, you're on WNYC. Hello, Gary. Gary, are you there? I guess Gary gave up. Gary was going to ask, according to my screener, about the history of Ronald Reagan's pro-gun control stance when he was governor of California, and mm-hmm. that the politics at that time were to get assault weapons in particular and other guns out of the hands of Black Panthers, who were mm-hmm. deemed a threat to the police. When the shooters are the current population you described, we keep seeing in these incidents, disaffected white males, the politics of law enforcement get stood on their heads or wind up somehow different. Does your research suggest that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Mulford Act was, a 1967 act that banned the public carrying of loaded firearms in incorporated areas, which meant that it didn't affect many neo-Nazi and militia groups that were operating at the time, but it did most certainly affect the Black Panthers. And that was, very clearly the point of the law. I think that when we think about this split today, we have to think about sort of how You know, if we think about how race divides how gun laws are actually played out and what gun laws are supported versus not, it really comes down to this, you know, the war on crime and sort of criminalizing gun use. So again, going back to this idea that we actually do have gun control, but it looks like crime control in the U.S. So we have, you know, Reagan signed into law as president, Career Criminal Act, the mandatory sentences that actually, you know, allowed for the more aggressive prosecution of criminals who use guns or have guns in their possession while committing a crime. And that is very different from sort of expanding access to guns for, you know, people who have passed the vetting process and are, you know, law-abiding citizens then, who are you know, owning and carrying guns. And so I think that's where the racial politics really plays out. And it maps onto these different kinds of, very differently racialized forms of gun violence, urban gun crime versus the active shooting. And I use those as kind of archetypes in the book to sort of unpack the racial politics of all of this.
Jennifer Dawson Carlson, we'll look for your forthcoming book, Policing the Second Amendment. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.